If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. On the 23rd of January 1978, Baron Edouard Jean Ampin was snatched from the streets of Paris in an audacious kidnapping attempt. Before long, a ransom of 80 million francs was demanded. And to show that the kidnappers meant business, they chopped off the Baron's little finger, with the disturbing warning that more body parts would follow. And this wasn't the worst of it. In his new book, The Last Baron, Tom Sankton charts the two tangled months of the kidnapping case, which led to a bloody shootout and ultimately the fall of the industrial giant, the Ampin dynasty. Emily Briffitt spoke to Tom to find out more.
Tom, it's lovely to be chatting to you today.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Now, your new book, The Last Baron, follows the kidnapping of Baron Edouard Jean Ampin in 1978, but also charts the history of one of Europe's major industrial juggernauts. To start us off, can you run us through what happened? How did a baron come to be kidnapped?
He was a very prominent member of the French establishment. He was an industrialist who was the head of one of the world's most powerful industrial groups that had activities in banking, energy, transport, all sorts of things, especially nuclear energy. His company had a monopoly on the construction of all the French nuclear power plants. So he was a very prominent, important figure. His company was crucial to French economic and security interests. And so he was somebody who was, during this decade of the 1970s, when there was a whole wave of kidnappings, he was somebody who was a pretty logical target for kidnapping. He was also perceived to be fabulously wealthy. And the company, of course, had sales up in the tens of billions of francs. So the kidnappers assumed they could make a quick killing with not literally killing, but a killing with a ransom, and so that's kind of how he was in the crosshairs of this group of kidnappers. So on the January 23rd, 1978, they launched the operation and very easily snatched him in front of his house as he got into his chauffeur-driven car, and then that was the beginning of this whole true crime caper.
I'm going to jump back, as you say, to this true crime investigatory story. But you spoke about his company. I'd like to give us a bit of context, really situate the story. So can you explain what the Ampin industrial empire was and perhaps its significance in Europe at this time?
Yeah, well, it was founded by his grandfather, the first Baron Ampin, and who was Belgian. He was born into a modest family in Belgium in 1852. He was one of those remarkable figures like J.D. Rockefeller or Cornelius Vanderbilt in the U.S., one of these self-made men who was actually driven by ambition and vision, and created this industrial group that was based on railroads, transportation, energy, civil engineering. And he built this empire little by little and became very prominent in the building of railroads and tramways. In fact, he built railroads all over Europe and in parts of Asia. And he became one of the founders of the builders of the Paris Metro around 1900. And also, he was into all sorts of things. He built this incredible, fantastic city on this desert of Egypt, north of Cairo, called Heliopolis, the city of the sun. I mean, he created this whole city. He was one of these visionary, driven kind of international capitalists. And when he died in 1929, he was one of the world's wealthiest men. So his son was Jean Opin, also known as Johnny. He took over the company. He was kind of a different sort. He was a hedonist. He was much more interested in throwing wild parties in his chateau and cruising the world on his yacht than he was minding the store. But he was seconded by good professional managers, and the company continued to grow and thrive. So by the time his son, which is our hero, the one who was kidnapped and who was known to his friends as Watteau. Okay, by the time Watteau finally took over in the late 60s, the company was really essential to the French economy in a number of ways, and particularly through its monopoly of the creation of nuclear power plants. And so that's in a nutshell the story of the rise of this great industrial empire, which comprised 175 companies and employed about almost 150,000 people in a dozen different countries. So this was a pretty big deal, the Opin-Schneider industrial empire.
So I guess this really gives us a framing of why the kidnapping of Edouard would be significant.
Yeah, well, it was significant because of how important the group was to French economic interests and security interests. And also, he was a member of the French establishment. He was half Belgian, half American, but actually his whole activity, his chateau, his company headquarters were all in Paris. So for all intents and purposes, he was a prominent member of the French establishment. He was a friend of the president, Giscard d'Estaing. And he was somebody whose survival was considered important, you know, to French interests, not to mention to the interests of the group and the interest of his family, of course. And so Giscard ordered one of the biggest police investigations in French history, and it involved 80 French detectives working pretty much around the clock. So this was it was a big deal, and I was actually studying in France at the time, and I remember this. When this news flash came, and it was in all the headlines, and the French press went absolutely ballistic, you know, calling it the kidnapping of the century. On one level, it's a police story and a, you know, manhunt, and on another level, it's really a saga about the rise of this dynasty.
There's so many things you mentioned there that I really like to pick on as we chat. But you were saying about how you actually found out about this story, having studied in France. And I think one of the really interesting things about your book is actually the way you went about researching it. Can you tell us more about that side of things?
Yeah, well, that was a very interesting subject to research, because it involved, I guess, two disciplines that I had learned. First, historical research, pure historical research. I have a doctorate in modern history from Oxford University. So my first discipline, my first training was in the methods of the historian, but also spent 20 years as a writer and correspondent for Time magazine, and much of that time as the bureau chief in Paris. And so there's a reportorial side of this too, which involved the journalistic methods of particular interviews. And I was lucky enough to get access to people who were key players in this thing. Well, I guess the main one was the head kidnapper, Alain Caillol, who actually organized this thing. And he's now 80 years old, a free man after spending decades in prison for various capers. But he's a very very interesting man. He's very erudite. He has a passion for books and grand opera. He was born to a fairly wealthy family, attended posh boarding schools, and really not at all the profile of your average gangster. But early on, he embraced a life of crime as an act of revolt against his domineering father. And he launched a career as a bank robber, and then finally came up with this idea of hitting a big jackpot and retiring. The big jackpot was the ransom that they expected to get from kidnapping Baron Opin. Well, he was one figure, but there were maybe four or five of the detectives who had been intimately involved in this story who talked to me One was André Bizet, who had kind of coordinated the whole investigation. He was a kind of a hard drinking, hard boiled cop who moonlighted as a crooner in a dance band. Another one is Jean Mazieri, was a Eurasian martial arts expert who was assigned to immobilize the kidnappers with his bare hands when they came to get the ransom. Then there was Commissaire Boussard, legendary figure in the history of the French police, and also members of the family. Watteau's half-sister, Diane, was very helpful. His daughter, Patricia, was very helpful. So these are people that I could actually meet and talk to and interview using the methods of journalism. So with those two methods of historiography and journalism, I was able to put together a story which dealt on basically on two tracks, one with the kind of the tick-tock of the kidnapping and its aftermath, and the other, that whole multi-generational saga, corporate history, the deeper backstory to the kidnapping.
There seems to be such a colourful cast of characters in this story. So with that, could you give us more detail on what actually happened? What is the kidnapping story?
Okay, well, what happened was on the morning of January 23rd, 1978, Baron Ampin, Watteau, came out of his posh apartment building at 10:20, his usual time, and was met by his chauffeur. He got into the car, and the car had driven only a short distance before a motor scooter came around it and slid and fell over in front of it. And the chauffeur hit the brakes, said, "You know, what's going on?" honking his horn. Then a van pulled up behind the car and blocked it from behind, and there was another van parked just on the side of the road. And four or five men emerged from that van, and four people from the van behind it. So four of the kidnappers jumped into the car. They grabbed the chauffeur and threw him out, put him in another van. And then they jumped in two in front, two in back. They put a hood over Watteau's head. They handcuffed him and put a gun to his head and said, do what we say or we'll blow your brains out. So that was the beginning. And then they drove off. They parked the car in a parking garage and switched cars, because at that time they were in Ampin's own car when they grabbed him. So then they switched cars and took him after nightfall, took him to a secluded spot in about 20 miles north of Paris, located in a forest, and it was an abandoned stone quarry. German occupiers had used it to store V-2 rockets during the war. It was just this warren of underground tunnels that had been abandoned. They had set up tents, you know, pup tents, and the wherewithal to stay a few days. They expected it to last only a few days. So this tunnel into which Watteau was introduced was unheated. So it's in January. It's just a few degrees above freezing. No electricity, obviously, no light, no heat. And he was blindfolded. So he's led into this tunnel, put in a tent, his chained to the wall by a neck chain, and his hands and feet were also chained. And one of the kidnappers came and said, "First of all, you always have to put on your blindfold when we approach you, because if you ever see us, we'll execute you immediately," because they didn't want to be identified. And then they said, "And now we want you to read this document." And they showed him a typed document that they prepared that said that they were going to demand a ransom of 80 million francs, which is equivalent to about $70 million today. They asked him for the name of contact people at his company. And then they said that they were going to cut off his little finger to show they meant business. The first thing he said, he didn't say anything about the finger. He just said, "Well, you're completely out of your minds. You know, I don't have that kind of money available. And I can't, whatever money I have, I can't free it up if I'm not there to sign papers. I can't do it with a phone call." And so they said, "You're just bluffing. We'll get around to that later." But they gave him a concoction to drink, which was kind of Valium and red wine, and which put him to sleep eventually. And then they cut off his finger. They put it on a paper cutter, one of these guillotine-style paper cutters, put his finger under the blade, hit it with a mallet, and that was it. And put his finger in a little jar of formaldehyde, which they then took and deposited in a storage locker at the Gare de Lyon, the railroad station, along with some of his identity papers and a letter demanding this ransom. And so the next day, one of his colleagues got a phone call saying, okay, go to locker number whatever at the Gare de Lyon and you'll find a little surprise. And so he went there with a policeman. They find this thing, ransom note, the finger, ID papers, and they realized that these guys, A, they held Watto, and B, they were ruthless, and they meant business, and they threatened to send other body parts unless the ransom was paid immediately. So that was how the whole thing started.
What was the law enforcement's response to this? Surely finger in a locker is going to send off some alarms. How did they react?
Well, they were very concerned. One of the detectives told me that they really expected that it was quite possible that they would be receiving, you know, a hand or a foot or, you know, an ear or something. The police were very concerned. I mean, it's a very important man, Giscard d'Estaing. The president was putting pressure on the police to try to find him immediately, make sure no harm came to him. The police chief, a man named Pierre Ottavioli, who was a legendary figure in French law enforcement, he was actually in Los Angeles visiting friends at the time. He didn't get back for a few days. When he did come back, he organized this team, as I said, of 80 detectives, and they were working around the block. But they had very few clues at first because the kidnappers were professional. In one sense, they were not that bright. They were like the Keystone Cops in one sense, but they had professional methods like not leaving fingerprints and things like that. So the police immediately had no clues, and there were no witnesses. There were virtually no eyewitnesses. All this took place in broad daylight, right on a major thoroughfare. So the French and the French police in the beginning were stymied. They were actually absolutely stymied. They had, you know, the police have informants. They have a whole network of people in the underworld. They tapped their informants. Nobody knew anything. They received a lot of tips, anonymous tips, phone calls, letters, claiming to know something about the case. But all that led to nothing. So for a long time, they just came up empty. But one of the key aspects of the police response was that the police chief, Pierre Ottavioli, insisted that no ransom be paid. Because in the beginning, the family wanted to pay the ransom and get him back. And they realized they didn't have that much money available. Ompin owned a lot of stock, but he didn't have a huge pile of cash sitting in the bank. The company, the industrial group, the people who were running it in Watto's absence, they didn't want to just pay it straight out. They offered to lend money to the family at a not particularly generous rate of interest. And so initially, after the first few days, the colleagues were able to get together 30 million francs instead of 80 million. There was a phone call, contact with the kidnappers, and the kidnappers said, "Do you have the money?" The interlocutor on the other side said, "Well, we have 30 million, not a cent more." And the kidnapper said, "Well, tomorrow you will have a cadaver," and hung up. So that was the end of any attempt to actually pay the ransom. So as I said, Police Chief Ottavioli, who arrived from the U.S. a couple of days later, said, absolutely no ransom. We will not pay a ransom. In many cases, when a ransom is paid, they still leave a body by the roadside. He had a different idea. He would concoct a fake ransom using pages of a telephone book cut in the size of Swiss banknotes, shrink-wrapped with real banknotes on the top and bottom of each packet, but basically it's all paper. And it filled two sports bags, weighed about 50 kilos. And he was going to lure the kidnappers into a trap, into an ambush, with the promise of this ransom, which was, as I say, a fake ransom. That was basically what the French response was. Initially, not panic, but a very intense concern for Watto's safety, and a lot of frustration because they didn't have any good leads in the beginning and didn't really know where to look. But I think the key thing was the police chief said, well, okay, we will lure them with the promise of a fake ransom and try to capture at least one of them as a counter hostage. So once you have a hostage, then you can use that hostage to put pressure on his confederates to release the Baron. So that was basically the police game plan. And in the end, it worked.
How were the kidnappers actually found out and caught in the end then?
That's one of the most interesting parts of the whole story. There were eight of them. It was really a motley crew. They were car thieves, pimps, drug pushers, some brighter than others. Kyle himself was, the organizer. He was, as I said, erudite, smart, cultured. Some of them were really kind of lowbrow criminal types. So what happened was there was a rendezvous on a French highway, the A6 highway, south of Paris. And two of the kidnappers showed up to get the ransom. Well, as I said, it was actually a fake ransom, but it was delivered by the martial arts expert, Jean Mazieri, that I mentioned, the Eurasian martial arts expert. And his assignment was at the moment where they met up to hand off the ransom, he would immobilize them with his hands, because he told me that he could have immobilized up to five or six people at once by just quick moves and just what he knew how to do. But what happened when he showed up, the Mazieri showed up with the fake ransom in his car. He was supposed to retrieve a message. He'd been through a whole scavenger hunt, they were sending him all over the place. He was supposed to retrieve a message about exactly how to meet the kidnappers. And just, he pulled off to the side of the road, and then a tow truck pulled up behind him, thinking he was, he needed to be taken to a garage, and that he was, his car had broken down. So Mazieri got out to wave away the tow truck. And at that point, Cayol and one other man, Daniel Duchateau, the co-organizer of the kidnapping, kind of jumped over from the top of a wall, jumped into Mazieri's car, where he'd left the key. And they go driving off, because, thinking, okay, well, the ransom's in the back, and we can just sort of drive off and disappear in this car. But he didn't realize that they were surrounded by a whole flotilla of police cars that were unmarked. They were like postal vans, ambulances, taxis, and everything. And so they were very quickly cut off, and there was a shootout. Kyle was badly wounded. His colleague, Daniel Duchateau, was killed. And so that was how Kyle was captured. So Kyle was then taken to a hospital, what they call the jailbird wing of this hospital, where people who were under police control were treated. And the police basically exfiltrated him to police headquarters, and they started working on him, telling him that if anything happened to the Baron, his head could roll, because France still had capital punishment at that time. It was only abolished two or three years later, and they still used the guillotine. So he made a call to the people who were holding Watteau and said to release him. And basically that's how he got released. So Duchateau is dead. Kyle is apprehended. And the French, the police were able to trace the number that Kyle had telephoned, where the Baron had been kept incarcerated. And so by tracing that, they went and found this house. It was had been abandoned by them, but they found all sorts of information, photographs, plane tickets, and the place had been rented in the name of brother-in-law of one of the kidnappers. And basically, they were able to then follow the trail with pretty brilliant police work from the point where they identified that house and were able to recover documents, names, and they would just kind of work their way through from one to the other. And within, I'd say, 8 months, they had actually rounded up all of the eight suspects.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
In a way, I wouldn't say it was inevitable that he would be a target, but it kind of was logical that somebody like Watteau in that era, in that position, was likely to become a target.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
It's an incredible story between, like, say, amputated fingers to shootouts to martial artists getting involved in the police investigation. It's crazy. How did the press and the public react to this story?
Oh, well, the press went, as I said, went ballistic in the beginning. You know, it was just this sensational story, the Baron Ampin kidnapped. And then they followed, there was not that much news that came after, because for a long time, the police were stymied and there was just nothing to report. You know, it's like, all quiet on the Western Front. And so after a while, the press sort of relegated the story to sort of the inside pages. But one of the things that was really important about the information that leaked out in the press was information about Watteau's personal life, because he was a high-stakes gambler. He was really addicted to high-stakes gambling. And he had mistress, one mistress in particular, but he had several mistresses, and he had a garçonnière, a little private apartment in Paris where he would meet his lady friends. And somehow or other, this leaked into the press. And this was absolutely devastating for his image, because up until that point, he was considered, you know, this major industrialist, a key figure in the French establishment, an aristocrat. Well, he wasn't really an aristocrat. His grandfather had gotten a title from the Belgian king because he was just his recognition of his achievements as an industrialist. So all of a sudden, his image is tarnished and destroyed by these revelations about, he had millions and millions in gambling debts. And of course, in France, it's probably maybe not the end of the world if you're found out to have a mistress, but it all added up to something that really tarnished his image. And the thing about the gambling also spurred speculation that he may have had his finger cut off for unpaid gambling debts, which is something that happened, you know, the mafia was known to do. And there was some sense that his presence in the casinos and the, you know, very high-stakes gambling that he did had attracted the attention of criminal elements and maybe was the reason why he'd been chosen as a target. Anyway, the press revelations about his private life were absolutely devastating and had major consequences for him after his liberation.
How did this image tarnishing affect his family's legacy as well?
Well, it was obviously devastating to the family's image, the family's image of him, the family's relationship to him. Once he was released, I mean, he thought that he was going to be, you know, people throwing confetti from the balconies and champagne, you know, finally Baron Ampin is free. And he got a very cold reception from his wife and his family. He said at one point, and he wrote this in his memoir, that he basically went from one prison to another. One prison was where he was incarcerated, and the other prison was the life that he emerged into, where he realized he was not free to live the life he had lived before. His wife divorced him. He was alienated from his children, more or less. And the worst thing that happened was that the people who ran the company, particularly the number two who ran the company in his absence, a man named René Ingen, basically told him that he should basically remove himself from the leadership, at least temporarily, because it was bad for the image of the company, that shareholders were not pleased at all to find out of all these huge gambling debts. And so he took a temporary leave. He took one of his mistresses and came to the U.S. and stayed several months and considered even just kind of relocating to America and starting his life over again. Ultimately, he went back, kind of had this confrontation with his number two and said he was taking over the company again. That lasted a short while, but it became apparent to him that it wasn't going to work. And so he was forced basically by circumstances to sell out his one-third share in the group that his grandfather had founded and was no longer part of the group. And within a few years, the whole Ampin group was kind of sold off, spun off in bits and pieces, and the Ampin name disappeared. That was really the end of this Ampin industrial dynasty that was founded by the grandfather. And it was really the kidnapping and the revelations about Ampin's private life that led to this really tragic end for him. was really like, I'd say the arc of his rise and fall is akin to a Greek tragedy. So that was, well, to a large extent, the consequence of all this information that came out in the press and ultimately tarnished his image to the point where his life was never the same again. Very sad story, really.
So how did this affect the family more widely?
The family, initially, they had different reactions to the kidnapping and the ransom demand in the beginning. He had two daughters, one, Patricia, who was, I think, 19 or 20 years old at the time, married to an American, and she was 6 months pregnant at the time. Christine was her younger sister, I think 2 years younger, and they had a brother, Jean-Francois, who was, I think, about 13 years old at the time. He was off at boarding school, and he wasn't so directly involved. But the two girls, they wanted their daddy back, and they said, well, whatever it takes, you know, let's just sell off a few companies. And they didn't realize that, you know, having a preponderant share in the group did not mean that he owned all 175 companies, that he could just sell a company and take the money and pay off the ransom, and that was that. So they were very disturbed and confused. They just didn't understand how they couldn't come up with the money. The wife, Silvana, who was Italian, she had no clue about his business affairs. She kind of enjoyed being wealthy, being the Baroness and everything, but she didn't really know at all what was what his business consisted of and how, you know, the details of the industrial group. She thought that if she sold her jewelry collection, maybe that would help, which was sweet, but it was not going to get up to 80 million francs. His mother was a real piece of work. The mother was American. Her name was Roselle Roland. She grew up in Columbus, Ohio, and she was a former exotic dancer, a stripper, if you will. Watteau's father, Jean Ompin, the playboy hedonist son of the founder, caught her act in London at the Dorset Hotel in 1935 and was absolutely smitten by her and kind of whisked her away on his yacht. And 2 years later, she gave birth to a son who was Watteau, the future kidnapping victim. And so from having been a stripper, he married her and she became a baroness. And she was a very scheming, self-centered, cold figure, showed no affection for anybody. She was really kind of an odious person in a lot of ways. Well, to cut back to these discussions within the family about how to deal with the kidnapping, she said, well, I won't pay a cent, you know. I'm not going to give a cent. She had a lot of money. She said, if he comes back, he'll have the money. But she refused to pay. So there was this really horrible argument within the family. She thought it was good for him. She thought that it would take him down a peg because he was arrogant and just a bit too haughty for her taste. She thought this would be a humbling experience. She never thought anything would happen to him. And she wasn't particularly worried about him. So that was kind of the immediate reaction of the family. And afterwards, when he was liberated under the cloud of these revelations, the children were basically estranged from him. It really destroyed the family. It broke up the family. There was also a half-sister, Diane, because Goldie, after her husband died, took up with a famous French jockey. They had a love child named Diane, who was Watteau's half-sister. And Diane became one of my key sources years later. She remained close to Watteau to the end, maybe the one who was closest to him. And she stuck by him all to the end. He never licked the gambling habit, and it really ruined him. All the money he gotten from selling his stock basically just kind of dwindled through his gambling. He was forced to sell the family chateau. He lived in a kind of handsome manor house near on the former chateau grounds, but he was just completely immersed in debt. He would borrow money from his friends and not pay it back. And at the end, he was virtually penniless. His sister Diane stuck by him to the end, and in fact, she's the one who took him to the hospital when he finally collapsed from various ailments. That was really the end of him at age 80. But it is a sad story. I mean, I'd call it a Greek tragedy, but in the sense that it's the fall of a powerful person, partly due to his own flaws. Because if what really happened to him, which really derailed his life, was not the kidnapping per se, but the revelations about his own flaws. And that was really the chink in his armor, and that's what ultimately led to his ruin.
You've spoken about this story offering a panorama of life at this time. What can this story tell us about the wider context of France and, I guess, Europe more widely? Because we've got ties to Belgium here as well.
One thing is that during this decade, it was called the Decade of Lead. It was a decade in which there was just a tidal wave of kidnappings, many of them political. This one was not political. Some thought initially it was the radicals, you know, taking this capitalist, snatching this capitalist, and maybe assassinating him. But it was not that. But there were many other kidnappings at the time that were political. The head of the German Employers Union, Hans Martin Schleyer, was kidnapped and assassinated by the Red Brigades just a couple of months before Robato. Aldo Moro, the former Italian prime minister, was kidnapped by the Red Brigades and assassinated a few months after Watteau, after Watteau's liberation. So what one thing it says about the 1970s is that this was a period of violence, of kidnappings, of political violence. One thing that's interesting is that the police response to Watteau's kidnapping, the adamant refusal to pay the ransom, and the fact that the kidnappers were all rounded up, it ended very badly for them. This actually virtually put an end to this spate of kidnappings in France, at least. More broadly, I think it says something about the 1970s, you know, the kind of the image of capitalism, of capitalists. There was the, you know, 1968, it was this big upheaval in France and elsewhere, kind of this youth revolt against the establishment and basically against people like Watteau. That had settled down by then, but they were still, France was still living in the kind of the wake of 1968. And the sense that people like Watteau were considered by many, many people, particularly obviously on the left, as you know, part of the establishment, the bad establishment that they were opposed to. It was also, in a major sense, the end of an era. It was the end of the De Gaulle era. You know, De Gaulle survived the revolt of 68, but in 69 he resigned. In 1970, he died. And so that was really the end of this era, the beginning of the Fifth Republic in France under the domination of Charles de Gaulle. And so it was also a period, his successor, Georges Pompidou, was collector of modern art, and he was somebody who wanted to really remake the urban face of Paris, and did to some extent. The face of Paris was really changing during this period, and also the importance of nuclear energy in France, because of the oil shock in 1973, you know, forced the French to kind of rethink their energy policy, and they opted for pretty much an all nuclear energy policy. And Ompin's company was selected to build all those power plants. So this is another aspect of this era. And also, and more broadly, there was a lot of change in French society. You know, it was kind of the disco era and beginnings of certainly a liberation of sexual culture, the beginnings of the coming out of gay culture. I mean, it was a period of, I think, an important period of transition in many, many ways, the 1970s in France. In Europe in general. And this is a context in which Watteau's kidnapping took place. It could have happened maybe in another era, but the fact that this was a time of political violence, this wave of kidnappings, and in a way, I wouldn't say it was inevitable that he would be a target, but it kind of was logical that somebody like Watteau in that era, in that position, was likely to become a target of political violence and, you know, kidnapping and... And so that's the context in which it happened.
That was author Tom Sankton. His book, The Last Baron, The Paris Kidnapping That Brought Down an Empire, is out now, published by Dutton. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Jack Bateman.